Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. Well, Susan, it's about time that we took a show and we dedicated it specifically to the subject of Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Many of you out there, whenever you hear the word Medicaid, you think one of two things. You think, gee, that's not relevant to me. That's for poor people. That means that you must not be poor. But there are others of you, though, who hear that and think, oh, that's a thing that I'm continually wondering about because I realize that that may be the only way I can pay for my long-term care. And how you react to whenever you hear the reference to the word Medicaid may, in fact, reflect your financial circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you are affluent, or at least compared to many people, if you're affluent, you may not think you're affluent, but if you have the ability and the intention to pay for your long-term care at the rate of, what, Susan, isn't it now easily
$10,000 a month is
easily,
kind of the amount I hear a lot.
Yeah, $10,000 and a number that's going up, and there are certainly opportunities to spend $12,000 a month and mm-hmm. $13,000 in the St. Louis area. So if you are one of those people who have the intention and the ability to pay that on a monthly basis, then maybe this conversation over the next hour, though I hate to lose you, you may not find it as useful to you. And then, of course, those who will readily qualify for Medicaid, you may not find it as useful. You'll hear some things that will help you because you will be relying on Medicaid. So if you're very low income, and I mean you got to be very low in order to meet these thresholds, but if you're in that bracket, then I think you'll still benefit from hearing the show because you'll learn some of the mechanisms and whatnot for getting signed up and getting qualified. We won't go into a lot of detail, but we do want to give you some practical information. But most of the people listening are in that bell curve in the middle,
mm-hmm.
you know, the middle class, quote unquote. I mean, you are the ones who will most benefit from this discussion.
Well, and we want to give you today some information that you will find useful. Medicaid is one way to pay for long-term care. Many of us are going to face long-term care. So let's just briefly talk about there is the self-pay option.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That is a way that people can do it.
Just write a check every month.
You write a check every single month. A lot of people are under the misconception that I think Medicare will pay for their long-term care. And that's really not the case once you've reached a particular threshold of disability.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. some of you know this already. Many others will find out. That,
the hard way, probably.
Yeah, that even though Medicare has pretty darn good coverage for a lot of things, still, when it comes to the question of paying for long-term care, it generally refers to what you might call chronic care or custodial care is another phrase that's used, which are outside the definitions and the qualification for Medicare. Medicare, keep in mind, is health insurance. It's not intended to pay for the cost of your custodial care when you reach an age where you cannot take care of yourself.
The phrase I've heard often when used about Medicare is you have to be getting better. As long as you're in the hospital or the rehabilitation center and you're getting better, you're making improvements, then Medicare will still cover. But the minute you stop making improvements and you've reached a plateau, that's when the struggle of this becomes long-term care kicks in.
Yeah, and that's generally true. I can quibble a little bit with some of the technical piece. Like there are circumstances, those of you who are listening, where you know you might need some care in order to maintain the same level of ability. But for the most part, that general definition is what you're safe to go with. So if you have something that needs treatment or diagnosis, and if it's an injury or an illness, what do we think about when we talk about those things? We talk about, as you said, Susan, diagnosing it and fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news is that's what insurance is for, health insurance is for, and that's what Medicare does. But if it comes to maintaining you in a facility, that it's less about treatment and it's less about diagnosis than it is about just keeping you functional or keeping you alive under conditions where you have the necessary support on a day-to-day basis. That's almost a housing expense. It falls somewhere between health care and housing.
Right.
And it's a little bit of both, of course. But for the most part, without going into a lot more discussion on this issue, we'll say that Medicare does have this transitional amount where it will pay for a certain amount of time in a nursing home. But again, this is intended to be therapeutic time, rehabilitative time. But depending on the definition, sometimes that complication can be ironed out so that you might get up to that 100 days that's provided per year of potential long-term care, or I should say nursing home skilled care costs. But that doesn't mean it's 100% paid. Only the first 20 days are paid full. The other 80% is a co-insurance, or the other 80 days is a co-insurance. But keep in mind, this is not an exception to the rule I mentioned a while ago. It still means that this has to be rehabilitative in some sense of the word and not simply custodial care. But there is provision for a skilled care facility for up to 100 days per year with a lot of ands, buts, or qualifications.
And I think what happens to a lot of people is they have, especially as we age, there's an accident, perhaps a fall, perhaps a change in the health, just where suddenly something gives way. There's been a surgery, and instead of making the improvement, suddenly it becomes an issue that is now chronic. And I think that's where we often get caught with, oh dear, now what do I do? And Medicaid can then become an option for many people.
Yeah, Medicaid is one of those things that it's there in the event that you do need long-term care. It's even there for you if you have some assets, provided that you qualify. So it's possible to qualify for long-term care and still have some assets beyond what is the formal definition, which now in Missouri is like $3,000 for an individual or $6,000 for a couple.
And let's make things a little bit clear as well. Medicaid can be available to younger people provided their income is low. But when we're looking at 65, is that where we're looking just at assets or income? How does that work? What are we looking at?
Well, it's mainly, if you're old, it's mainly a qualification based on, number one, are your financial resources such that you would be eligible, which means your assets and your income have to be down to a certain level. The other piece is, do you need the skilled care? And that's defined as a certain number of ADLs, activities of daily living. There are generally five. Sometimes there's an instrumental definition that includes six or more. But typically if you have three ADLs, which means maybe help getting transferred, help showering or bathing, help eating. I mean, there are a variety of these fundamental tasks that we all do daily and we take for granted. But if you have it certified or someone corroborate, a healthcare professional, that you can't do these things or you need assistance, then you probably have the physical need piece met. And now it becomes primarily the financial piece. And I'll tell you, that is the, when you hear of obstacles to qualifying for Medicaid, rarely is the obstacle whether or not you can establish that you'll benefit from the care in a skilled care facility. But sometimes that comes up. They are starting to tighten the requirements to assure that people are not simply going into skilled care facilities because that's the only way they can get it paid for when they don't really need that level of care.
Yeah, I wondered what provisions were in place to prevent people from doing that. I mean, I have run into people where they just are kind of destitute and they figure this is a good way to, I'm going to end up there eventually. I might as well start now.
Well, it was a flaw in the system. CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which essentially oversees the administration of Medicaid and Medicare nationwide, they've recognized in the state, their state counterparts have recognized that right now the incentives are all wrong. The incentives are to have people to do all they can to qualify for Medicaid and get into a long-term care facility in order to get Medicaid to pay, whereas the real problem is that they don't have somebody to pay for their care at home, and they're choosing go into skilled facilities simply because that's the only way they can get the Medicaid to pay. It was a crazy set of circumstances. I'm happy to report that it's changing.
Okay,
and,
good.
In all the states, including Missouri, there's a push for people to get Medicaid benefits at home. Now, naturally, the amount's different, et cetera. Some of the criteria are a little different in terms of the focus being on income-based, et cetera. But still, it's called home and community-based waiver services. And there's a big push in Missouri for people to start obtaining Medicaid benefits in a way that allows them to avoid perhaps ever having to go into long-term care in a skilled care facility. So this is an arrangement where Medicaid will pay, I think it's still at $10 an hour, maybe it's $11 now, but will pay up to, for example, $10 or $11 an hour for someone to come in your home and do those things that what you have to establish is these are the things that because they're being done, I'm able to avoid going into long-term care. So it can include skilled care at home. It can include unskilled care at home.
Now, are these what we have seen popping up along the commercials and among different businesses as consumer-directed services? That seems to be the name that I hear a lot, is that, well, a family member can come in and help take care of you, and then there are they can receive a payment for you to stay in your own home.
You know, that could be. I hadn't seen those particular ads. I haven't seen those particular ads, but it sounds like exactly what that is. And it's true, a family member, except a spouse is the only one that's excluded from this, but a family member can get paid to come in. Now, as you might imagine, the ceilings on this are significantly lower than 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea is for the state to save money. At some point, it's more expensive, obviously, for you to be getting care at home than if you went into the efficiencies of a facility. So where there's that level of need, then at some point you would want to go into a skilled care facility. But short of that, where you're talking part-time, someone coming in and helping. And, of course, it would consist, one would think, of a component that is unskilled, meaning a component who comes in and helps with housekeeping, maybe lifting you or helping you or being kind of that attendant. And then, in addition, somebody who may come in for certain therapeutic tasks, such as, for example, somebody who does respiratory therapy or various types of therapy. Those are skilled workers, and they would also be covered. Remember, the single criterion here, which makes sense from the standpoint of a taxpayer, the single criterion is this, whatever it is, has to be keeping you out of a nursing home. It's mm-hmm. by virtue of this that you're avoiding going to a nursing home. And you can imagine that's not an onerous hurdle to get over. You'd think, as a matter of fact, that would exactly describe why this person's coming. But again, you cannot expect to incur the sort of costs and get coverage that would exist in a skilled care facility. At that point, it's diminishing returns for the taxpayer. So at that point, then there would be an expectation that you would go into that.
Well, and it sounds like the government is making some good choices along the way, because I think most people like to stay in their homes, and especially if a family member can come and help take care of you, that seems like a win-win for everyone. Now, let's maybe shift a little bit and look at those situations where perhaps it is time that the person can no longer be in their own home. How does that work? Can you guide us through the process? I mean, how long does it take? How time consuming is it? What sorts of verification do we need to prove that we don't have this amount of income or that we need the services?
Well, there are kind of two steps in terms of the application or the qualification process, I should say. And whenever you think that you're going to need or a loved one is going to need long-term care, it's probably going to be after an event or after a stay in a hospital in which somebody has told you or your family member that you can't go home in the foreseeable future. Sometimes that'll be expressed as, you know, there needs to be therapy or an effort to rehabilitate this person from their injury or whatever, surgery, whatever it might be, with the proviso that we have to wait and see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a standard scenario. So the person often an elderly person will be moved sometimes even to another part of the hospital. Some hospitals have their own in-house sort of skilled care facility.
Mm-hmm.
But others, you might be moved out. You might be moved to a nursing home where they do have those therapeutic services, whatever that might be, physical therapy. And the idea is, you know, well, Medicare is paying, incidentally, at this point, remember. So assuming you're in the hospital for that 3-overnight rule, read carefully the fine print of your Medicare coverage.
You have to have spent at least 3 nights in the hospital before Medicaid will kick in.
And often people, it's better to understand that the way it's, because of its wording as 3 midnights. I think you're safe if you think of yourself as needing to be there 3 midnights. But assuming then that you are there for that period of time, then you're transferred over to a skilled care facility, then you're going to have, you'll qualify for coverage, because then it is falling under kind of the umbrella of treatment, right? And its intention is to see if you can get better. Doesn't mean that you're guaranteed to get better. So often there'll be a period of time when your loved one will be getting Medicare coverage as to some percent. Remember, 20 days, it's going to all be covered thereafter. It may be, I think it's an 80-20 split. But anyway, it is a split of sorts. But still, the good news is Medicare is paying much of it. And then if there is a point within that 100 days when the nursing home can no longer defend that you are in rehabilitation, for example, if you quit going or you quit showing any improvement, or you just don't feel like when they come to your room, say, let's go do the physical therapy, you don't feel like doing it, then any of those things could result in the nursing home having to say that, well, we can no longer take the position that we're doing rehabilitation. And nursing homes are protective of their status. They can get dinged if they are accused by CMS of profiteering, so to speak, on Medicaid. So they are sensitive to when they think that you can't legitimately be said to be under rehabilitation any longer. Or it could simply go to the 100th day. Mm-hmm. So you get to the 100th day and you're no longer eligible.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that's a little over 3 months.
Yeah, it can go fast. And at that point, then you need to have qualified. So many times, substantially before that day comes, it may be weeks before, maybe months before, depending on the heads up you might get, you are talking to the staff. You can get, they have people in the financial office who can give you some information. You're talking hopefully to a lawyer, hopefully to an elder lawyer, who can tell you about the prospect of qualifying for Medicaid if that's your intention. Again, as we started the show, I realize some people, they figure that they're not going to qualify, so they're not going to try, and their intention is if that time comes, we're going to write a check. And as long as we have money, we're going to keep writing that check, and then we're broke, then we'll take
and
Medicaid.
Then we'll do, yeah.
But others of you are thinking, well, no, I can afford to write some checks. I have this $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, generally significantly less than $1 million, but not always. And it's money that's been earned over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. There's a legacy that you hope to leave to your children and grandchildren. Perhaps you have other needs around you of other loved ones, et cetera. And your intention is that you really want to see if it's possible to qualify for Medicaid. And remember, this whole discussion is based on something perfectly legal and perfectly ethical. It's just like tax planning.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to insert this because some people I know struggle with the idea that, wait now, if I have $500,000 in assets, shouldn't I just go ahead and pay for it myself and let just poor people make application, even though I can qualify by the rules, not by breaking the rules, but by the rules, then I would say the perfect analogy to that is somebody who takes tax deductions that allows them to pay a rate of taxes significantly below what their tax bracket is.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue that has the same impact. It reduces the revenues that'd be available for redistribution to the poor, blah, blah, blah. And yet I think people are comfortable with the idea that, no, that's not somehow doing something underhanded, mm-hmm. that instead is being a good steward. Mm-hmm. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to minimize our tax liability. We have accountants whose job it is. We have loopholes that are deliberately placed in the code to generate certain types of behavior. So if whatever the reasons they're there, most people would say I have no hesitation
right.
in taking advantage of those. So I would suggest that you apply the same reasoning to this right here, in that you have a duty to those you love and those who are most dependent on you, perhaps, to be a good steward, which means to hire a lawyer to find out what does the law permit, and whatever the law requires of you, you pay. What it doesn't require of you, you don't pay,
mm-hmm.
which I think is always a sound policy. And so if that's the case, then you go see a lawyer and in these weeks or months leading up, and you say, is there a way that I have, is it reasonable for me to qualify? And sometimes the lawyer, remember, you want to choose a lawyer that does a lot of this. This is not something a general practitioner is going to be familiar with. You wouldn't go to a general practitioner for tax issues
mm-hmm.
and because clearly the tax code is complicated. You go to somebody who specializes in tax issues. And the same thing is true of this area. I don't say this is true of every area of the law. Some are more demanding in terms of technical detail than others. You know, if this were routine estate planning, we're talking about a will or a trust routine, I would reluctantly concede to you, because this is what we do, elder law. I mean, we do those things too. But no, I'd have to concede to you, is it possible that you go to a general practitioner and they can do those things? Well, if your estate's not complicated, I'll grudgingly grant you that. And the same thing for lots of things. Can a lawyer draft a contract for you?
Mm-hmm.
Can a lawyer review a lease on your apartment? I mean, there are a lot of things that a general practitioner can and should do, quite frankly. We shouldn't always have to use specialists for everything. But let me say this subject we're talking about right now, Medicaid qualification, it ain't one of those.
It's not going
to
happen.
It's not one of those. It's not one of those categories where a guy who's gone to law or a gal that's gone to law school is going to be fine. You know, just you walk in and they either know it or they pull a book off the shelf and then they know it enough to do you a reasonable job.
All right. So you've convinced me. I walk into you. What's the first thing you're going to ask me? I'm going to say, okay, I want to make sure I qualify for long-term care through Medicaid. Go.
Well, I would want to know some timelines. And let me introduce you to two important dates. And these dates you need to think about, because they're going to impact your qualification, and they're going to impact whether you will go in at all. But even if you could otherwise go in, whether or not you're going to meet the financial criteria. Number one, it's called a snapshot date. A snapshot date is defined as, and I'm going to sound technical here, but I'm going to go slowly because the purpose of this show is not for me to just impress you with what I know, although incidentally I don't mind doing that, but for you to walk away saying, yeah, I got that. I know a lot more than I did before. So a snapshot date is the first day of the first continuous 30-day period of hospitalization or institutionalization. Now, let's go back mm-hmm. and think about what that means. We're really talking about the first period when you are expected to be in a place for 30 days. In other words, it doesn't necessarily have to be the end of that period, but it's the expectation it'll be 30 days.
Okay.
But it can also be after the end of that period. So it's the first 30-day period of hospitalization. Now let's look at the first day of that period. Okay?
Okay.
Now, that is the snapshot date. What does that mean? When you think snapshot, what are you doing? You're capturing in a moment a picture.
A picture.
You're locking it down for that moment. And that's what this is intended to do about your qualifications financially. This is what the CMS will look at to determine if you or to determine a baseline for your qualifications. So let's assume that on the snapshot date that you have $300,000.
Okay.
That's okay. Remember, the snapshot date is not the date that you're making application.
Okay.
Now, the snapshot date is the date where they determine what your assets are and what your liabilities are. Don't worry about the fact that on that date you may not qualify or that you may have stuff that's a problem. That's okay. This just becomes a date for them to determine what portion of the assets will be available to set aside for the community spouse.
So let's say it's November 1st and on November 1st, I realize I'm going to be hospitalized or institutionalized for at least 30 days, but I don't apply until December 15th. My snapshot date is still November 1st. And
that's
so whatever
correct.
I have in my bank account, in my house, in my insurance, or whatever they're looking at, those are the things that we consider.
Yeah. And now keep in mind, though, the more narrow purpose that these are being considered. This snapshot date is defining the portion of the assets that the community spouse can keep. Now,
okay.
I know this is confusing. I wish there were a way to make this easier, but I want this to make sense to you. That remember, there was a law passed, we've talked about it before in this show, it goes actually before 07, but there was a revised statute that's passed in 06 in which the goal is to assure that the community spouse, that's the spouse that's living in the community, meaning the one that's not in the nursing home, and this effort to assure that they're not impoverished because of the person who's getting Medicaid. And there was a time when that was happening, quite frankly. Prior to 1992, that was a common phenomenon. And the original statute was passed to stop this and say, no, whatever happens, we have to assure that the person who's not in the nursing home, that husband or wife, has what they need to live. So the snapshot date is primarily to look at the assets at a point in time and decide, okay, this is what can be set aside for the community spouse. This is an important number. And I can tell you that you may say, well, gee, some of you listening will say, well, wait, I had one of those dates and it was about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I assume you've not applied for Medicaid. And now you're wondering, but now I'm out of money. I've been spending money or I'm getting low. And I think now I'm going to try to qualify. Well, believe it or not, that date, even though it zoomed past and it was 24 months ago, that's still the date. It's
okay.
Still the date. That is the date that will determine assets that are protected or available to the community spouse. This is a huge issue for married couples.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're very concerned about this date. And it's also an important date for planning. Sometimes I know you can't plan when that date occurs as you can the application date.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it is something where you can sometimes play with that date. And let me give you an example of how that can be helpful. Under the statute in Missouri, you can have up to approximately, I think, with the adjustments for inflation this year, I think we're now at 125, I think. So call it that you can potentially have as much available to a community spouse as much as $125,000.
In cash.
In cash.
Okay.
And now there are other assets and other provisions for houses and transportation, all that. Put that aside. I'm just talking about what is allowed generally without a special category, what's available for a community spouse. And it can be potentially $125,000,
mm-hmm.
potentially. Now, that's not going to happen if you have a total of, say, $200,000. Because if on the snapshot date you have a total of $200,000, what happens is there is a division of assets, as that word implies, division of assets. This number is cut in half. Now, ignore the half that's available to the person who's going into the nursing home. You have time to fix that later. Remember, this is not the application date. This is the snapshot date.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're really concerned about is the number that's falling on the other side of the line.
Right.
The other half, the half that's available to the community spouse. And you're wasting what would potentially be another $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you could instead have on the snapshot date $250,000?
Available to the spouse.
In total assets. Hmm. See, before the division of assets, total assets that will be considered, we'll call them countable assets. And let's not get into that definition now. we may come to that. But think of your total assets generally. So my point is, you would want to be higher than lower to assure that when you do a division of assets, cut it in half, then look and see how much is left for the community spouse. Oh, if it's too low, then money will be moved over from the side that would otherwise be attributed to the spouse, that's the institutional spouse, mm-hmm. will be pushed over and credited to the community spouse.
Okay.
But now that happens at a very low number. last time I checked the chart, we're like in the 20s, 20-something thousand bucks. So it can get low. But let's keep our eye on what's potential here in terms of the higher end. Well, the higher end is around 125,000 general funds. But again, we're not talking special categories. We can talk about those maybe on another show. So whenever you do your snapshot date, it's ideal if the number you have is 250 or above, mm-hmm. in some ways, mm-hmm. to assure that at least you're taking full advantage of that $125,000 that's protected. Now, I'm not saying that you benefit by creating more assets of which you lose 50 cents for every dollar.
Right.
Some people are saying, well, wait. So let's say you're saying...
Yeah, I had 250, now I'm down to 125.
Yeah, exactly. I lose half. So if I add more to get to the 250, don't I lose 50 cents of every one of those dollars to my institutional spouse accounting? And no, my point is you can move assets around in such a way to where on that particular date, mm-hmm. on that particular date, remember, this is the date that says I have this. This is not the date that is determined what you're going to have to give up for qualification. This is the snapshot date as opposed to the application date. So on the snapshot date, you don't necessarily lose the 50 cents of every additional dollar that you gain. So you want to have the numbers higher on the snapshot date. And then when you make application, some mm-hmm. people are saying, but aren't I making application on that date?
No, that's just the picture, right?
Yeah, but you could. I mean, I don't want to say that there is a rule that forbids that. There are some people who might do that, but I'm suggesting that's coincidental, or it's because you're choosing to do that. These two pieces of the process do not need to move together.
Okay.
But they need to be coordinated, but they don't have to occur at the same time, and often do not. This example I just gave you, you could have the snapshot date that occurred 2 years ago, ooh. And incidentally, there wasn't a snapshot taken, which mm-hmm. is the problem. Mm-hmm. So then if you make any effort to apply for Medicaid, they're going to ask for you to complete this asset division form, the statement of assets and liabilities. So when you're asked to fill out this form, they're going to want to know the information as one thing they'll want to know is the information as of the snapshot date. They'll also look at the information as of the application. So you can be sure that if you do decide that you want to apply for this, you're going to be required to disgorge a whole lot of information.
Okay, so the first thing you're going to ask us when we come to you talking about qualifying for long-term care through Medicaid would be, what is our snapshot date? What would be the next date that we need to look at? You said a couple of dates. Would that be the application date?
That would be the application date. And those can be widely separated and often are for the reasons I just mentioned. We'll start talking about, without getting into the issue at that stage, about what documentation exists, which, again, let me emphasize to those listening, whenever you are making application for Medicaid, as to either one of these pieces, the listing of assets and liabilities or the application itself, apart from the snapshot date, you're required to have a whole lot of information and detail. You have to be prepared to come with documentation supporting balances in your checking account, documentation supporting your brokerage account transactions going back 5 years. All of this goes back 5 years. Real estate transactions, you've got to bring that documentation. It's your responsibility to bring it. And let me mention also, I know sometimes I'll have somebody who might suggest cutting a corner or maybe being less than precise, I can tell you that the penalties are harsh.
Are they?
And we don't live in a world anymore, if we ever did, and we probably did at one time, where people, there weren't good records of such things, and people who were inclined to be dishonest, sometimes they got away with it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that happened years ago, but I guarantee it happens less often today. Mm-hmm.
So you really have to do your due diligence to gather the information and contact the banks and look at, keep your records. I mean, I keep thinking of people with everything in a shoebox and how difficult that would be at this particular time.
Yeah, it is. And it does, sometimes there may not be documentation, at least good documentation, and you have to settle, and you'll request that they settle for what records you have. And that's, sometimes they might, but the point is they have a right to demand, and generally do, detailed documentation to establish. Remember what they're looking for. They want to know, number one, what type of assets you have now accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, they want to know what transactions have taken place over the last 5 years. So those are two different things. One is, where are you now, which ties into whether you qualify at the outset. And the other is, was there a transaction in the past by which you tried to sidestep deliberately, incidentally, or unintentionally, mm-hmm. sometimes, but would preclude your being eligible now because of a penalty period, though you would otherwise qualify. So those are really the two sides of the coin that's being explored. So it requires accurate current information on all your assets. And include, incidentally, tax returns the last 5 years, so they can get those themselves. It's best to bring them. But also gather what information you can to substantiate the fact that there was this non-event, proving this negative event here. But still, it's the nature of this task.
Well, now we need to take a break. We're coming up on a time limit. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking about paying for long-term care with Medicaid. You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk. We have about 8 minutes left. And Susan, let's stick with the narrow topic that we're covering today, or this portion of the conversation that we're covering today relating to qualifying for Medicaid. And then we can pick up with the next show where we leave off today. So today, all I want to accomplish is to communicate about the application process versus the asset division.
Okay.
And the asset division, as it's called, is what we were talking about before we went into the break, and it's the point at which you have a snapshot point in time, and the snapshot date is the point in time when the Medicaid caseworker or a what they call an eligibility specialist who works for the Family Services Division,
okay,
when they will look at your assets and determine what portion can be set aside for the community spouse to assure the community spouse is not impoverished. So that is what we're calling asset division, and it's hugely important, and it does require a little bit of strategic thinking, or I would suggest you have it. But those of you who have a 30-day period already that's passed, and so your snapshot date is in the past, so there's nothing you can do to change what was true then, but you do need to preserve your records and whatnot so that you can be prepared to confirm, as CMS will require, and your eligibility specialist will require in your county, that you provide this documentation. Now let's move here in the next few minutes. I want to talk a little bit about the application and distinguish it. These two things can, as we mentioned a few moments ago, they can occur at the same time. But often what happens is that somebody will first have a separate date when that will be their snapshot date, and perhaps with no design. It was just true that's when it happened. Mm-hmm. And it might have been at that time that they didn't make application for Medicaid. And that's the reason, in fact, that they didn't create a record, because they didn't know they were supposed to create a record of that moment. So let's assume, though, that you have the ability to go back and reconstruct that. And it's, we'll say 5 months later.
Okay.
So 5 months later, you have this need, and maybe mom went home after the 30 days. Maybe mom was in this facility for 45 days and went home.
Does it start over?
It's still, the original snapshot date doesn't change.
Okay.
So it stays that date. So let's assume then, and we can, this is not unusual. Mom goes home, she doesn't improve. So finally it's concluded she's going to have to go into long-term care. So here we are 3 or 4 months later, and now what are you filling out? Well, in this case, you're going to have to look back and fill out the asset division that we talked about a few moments ago for the snapshot date. But you're also filling out a different document called the application. Now, the application, it'll contain typically different amounts because, what? Things have changed. So while you've locked down the portion that will go to the community spouse, that's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
So if you plan it correctly, when your application time comes, then the only look is, okay, is the person who's going to be, they call them the participant now, is the participant going to qualify? So you know already that one way of thinking about this math in terms of countable assets is take the amount that has already been declared by the snapshot date to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call it $125,000, we'll just say, without considering exempt assets. These are countable assets, okay? And now you know you get another $3,000, right? So one way of saying it is the applicant or the participant should not have on the application date more than $128,000. Now, those of you listening, do you get this? So we're taking the number that was locked down for the community spouse on the snapshot date.
Right.
And we're saying, okay, that's what's available for them. What's available for the person that's going into the nursing home? $3,000.
That's all they have, right?
Remember that. Yeah, remember,
right.
It's a very low ceiling.
Right.
Now, some of you, and we won't get into this week because we're almost out of time. Some of you are thinking, well, wait, don't you have a house that I heard something about an exemption? Yes, you have an exemption for a house. What about a car? Yeah, there are some special categories. I'm talking about countable assets. So we'll circle back to this conversation when we pick up the show next week. But I want you to be acquainted with these ideas of a snapshot date and why it's there, and of an application date. And the application date's the date that the participant's got to be broke. Remember that. That's
right.
The date that the participant's got to be broke to qualify, or $3,000.
$3,000 is the limit, right?
Yeah. So you walk into that application, putting aside exempt assets, and you need to be walking in with $128,000 in countable assets. And where we got that number, remember, was we were assuming that the snapshot date permitted the community spouse $125,000, right? We're assuming they qualified for the max. And then another $3,000, we'll say, which we know is permitted for an individual now in Missouri for the person that's going into long-term care. So you're at $128,000. So this is just for illustrative purposes. We'll circle back with this show next week.
Mm-hmm.
We'll pick up from here. But I hope that those of you listening took some notes so that when I pick up this conversation a week from now, we can kind of pick up at the same place. So I encourage you, those of you listening who have kind of followed this and understood it, which is hopefully all of you, then take a moment and write down some notes before our show next week, and then we'll step forward next week and deal with some additional topics that will help round out this picture for you. Boy, time has flown.
It's gone very, very quickly.
Well, in part, it's the nature of this topic. It's so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I look forward to visiting with you next week. We'll pick up this topic of Medicaid. This has been another episode of Elder Talk. Till then, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.